to make it penetrate and affect the mind of the listener. This simple procedure will make an effective speaker of anyone who follows it as a matter of daily habit, and nothing else will.
Mr. Carnegie, in our last discussion, you stressed the importance of the proper choice of words. Will you tell me now, sir, where the proper use of words fits into this business of effective speech?
Words will not produce effective speech unless they are grouped so as to convey ideas through illustrations and similes that are well within the experience of all. Remember this, because it is of the utmost importance to all who aspire to become effective speakers. I have heard some well-educated men make speeches which were masterpieces of English, but they failed to influence anyone because they were not properly attuned to the minds of the listeners through the right sort of illustrations. People wish to hear about subjects that help to solve their daily problems, subjects that aid them in their struggle for the necessities and the luxuries of life. People will listen to the discussion of other subjects, but they will be more greatly influenced when discussions are made interesting by dramatization and illustration. All people resent the use of words which they do not understand, no matter how correctly they may be used. Remember, then, that the effective speaker must not only use illustrations within the range of his listeners, but he must describe them in words which anyone of ordinary educational advantages may understand.
Mr. Carnegie, what about gestures? I've listened to some speakers who wildly beat the air and pounded the lectern in driving home their points. What is your opinion in this matter, sir?
Gestures can do only one of two things to a speech: either add to or detract from its effectiveness. If they do not add, they detract. Gestures should, therefore, be harmonized appropriately with the content of the speech. One should avoid distracting personal gestures, such as running the fingers through the hair, shoving the hands down in the pockets, and fumbling with watch chains or rattling coins. Also, one should avoid slouchy posture of the body. Such mannerisms may imply familiarity and take the mind of the listeners off the speech.
It seems to me, Mr. Carnegie, that a good many of the traits of a pleasing personality may be incorporated right into an effective speech. I'm thinking, for instance, of tone of voice.
The tone of the voice is important. It should therefore be controlled. High, harsh tones always offend the listener. The low, rich tones are much preferable. A voice that is off tone is as offensive as a musical instrument that is out of tune, and for the same reason. It destroys the harmony of the tone. Here again, remember that one should begin training the tone of the voice in ordinary conversation. A well-disciplined voice can convey feeling, not by the mere meaning of words alone, but by the tone of the voice, which produces either laughter or tears. The effective speaker must learn to distinguish between words that are spoken without feeling and those which depend almost, if not entirely, upon feeling for their influence on the listener. The tone of the voice is the instrument by which feeling is conveyed.
You'll agree with me, Mr. Carnegie, that another one of the traits of personality which obviously enters into effective speech is facial expression?
The effective speaker must remember to make the expression of his face fit the feeling he wishes to convey. Both the smile and the frown have their appropriate places in speech, but it is important that each should be used only at the right places. The governing rule is that the expression of the face should harmonize with the nature of the thought to be conveyed by speech.
Mr. Carnegie, what ingredient of a speech transmits the all-important feeling or mood of the speaker to the members of his audience and inspires them to react in the way the speaker desires them to respond?
Enthusiasm is the essential element of effective speech, which gives words the necessary feeling to enable a speaker to project his thoughts into the minds of listeners. It is difficult for anyone to close his mind against the enthusiastic speaker, or to keep his mind from being penetrated by the thoughts of one who speaks with the fire of enthusiasm back of every word. Enthusiasm is very contagious. It is a form of feeling that gives power to words as nothing else will.
If that's the case, Mr. Carnegie, please tell us how one generates this magic power of enthusiasm.
The starting point in the development of enthusiasm is sincerity of purpose and a complete belief of the speaker in the thought he is endeavoring to convey to others. Any attempt to feign enthusiasm where it is not actually felt by the speaker will be more than apt to be recognized and resented by the listeners. Here again, the tone of the voice speaks so loudly that mere words get in the way and serve only to expose the insincerity of the speaker who does not actually believe in what he is saying.
Could you tell us, Mr. Carnegie, what is considered to be the most effective speech of all time?
The speech which has been delivered more than any other is one of the shortest, one of the most dramatic, one of the most romantic, and sometimes one of the most tragic of all human speeches. It consists of only three words. I love you. Yet I have heard it said that the three short words are only incidental to the conveyance of the thought back of them. The thing that counts most, so experts on the subject tell me, is the tone of voice, the look in the eyes, and the feeling of enthusiasm the speaker sometimes puts back of this speech. When you can explain how one clothes that speech with the necessary feeling to make it effective, you will also know a great deal about how one dramatizes any speech with depth of feeling and enthusiasm. It all goes back to sincerity of purpose and desire. We have no trouble in giving feeling to speech when we believe what we are saying. Moreover, if we believe what we say and give our words the right amount of feeling, the world is apt to recognize us as having attractive personalities.
And what is the 19th trait of a pleasing personality, Mr. Carnegie?
Versatility. It is hardly necessary to mention the obvious fact that people who lack a general understanding of the world in which they live, including at least a surface knowledge of human nature, are seldom interesting or attractive. A general interest in things and people is one of the essentials of flexibility of personality, without which one is seldom attractive, except to a very small percentage of those with whom one associates. With books and educational advantages as plentiful as they are in our country, there is little excuse for any person neglecting to inform himself on a great variety of subjects. Every man should have at least a surface acquaintanceship with the vital topics of the day, especially those which are associated with the political and economic fortunes of his own country. A man should have at least a shade more than a surface knowledge of himself, for it is true that the man who understands himself knows a great deal about other people, and he is thereby qualified to make himself attractive to them. The man who really knows himself has little difficulty in knowing others, because he is so much like the others.
According to my count, Mr. Carnegie, you are now about to discuss the 20th trait of a pleasing personality, which is
a genuine fondness for people. Everyone who understands dogs knows that a dog instantly recognizes people who do or do not like dogs. Moreover, dogs express their recognition in no uncertain terms. People also recognize, with the slightest association, individuals who like people, and they resent those who have a natural dislike for others just as definitely as they are attracted to the person who likes people. The law of retribution always operates so that people are judged and dealt with not alone by their deeds, but by their dominating mental attitudes, through which they express their likes and their dislikes with unerring definiteness. It is inevitable, therefore, that the person who dislikes people will be disliked, although he may never openly express his feelings. Through telepathy, every mind communicates with other minds. Therefore, the person who wishes to have an attractive personality is under the constant necessity of watching not only his deeds, but also his thoughts.
What you have just said, Mr. Carnegie, seems to be closely related to what we commonly call a man's temper. Do you wish to explain your idea of temper?
I wouldn't expect very much in the way of achievement of a man who has no temper, because the thing we call temper is nothing but uncontrolled emotion, and emotion under control is one of the most essential of all the powers of the mind. Perhaps the greatest injury an uncontrolled temper does is that which results from an uncontrolled tongue. The person with an uncontrolled temper generally has a tongue that is mounted on ball bearings in the middle, so to speak, and swings loosely at both ends, with an edge as sharp as a razor blade, and with no regard for whom it cuts. We have all known of such tongues, but we have never been greatly attracted to the owner of any of them. Most people talk too much and say too little under the most favorable circumstances. But the man with a bad temper and a ball-bearing tongue often talks when he does not intend to do so, and says things that he lives to regret. Such a person obviously does not have an attractive personality.
What have you to say about those who express defeatism and accept failure as their lot in life?
Nobody cares very much for the person who has abandoned the hope of personal achievement or lacks the ambition to achieve some worthy objective in life. The world will forgive a man for most of his mistakes if he has high aims and definite hopes for their attainment, but it will not forgive him for failures due to indifference or hopelessness.
Mr. Carnegie, is it possible for a man to allow his personal habits to control him through lack of self-discipline and still remain attractive to other people?
Excess in the habits of eating, drinking, or sexual relationships destroys personal magnetism and makes the offender an object of derision among all who know him. I shall not preach on morals, but simply say that the man who hasn't enough pride in himself to control these intimately personal habits will more than likely be a failure in everything he undertakes, for these habits generally have associated with them other objectionable habits, which make the development and maintenance of an attractive personality impossible.
One of the most common causes of an unattractive personality, I should say, Mr. Carnegie, is the tendency to be grouchy, irritable, nervous, and impatient. Do you care to express yourself on this subject, sir?
Impatience is nothing but a visible expression of selfishness or lack of self-discipline. Consequently, it never inspires sympathy from anyone. It is a negative mental attitude that is caused usually by intemperate habits in connection with eating, drinking, and sex, which I mentioned before, or is due to poor health brought about by these forms of intemperance. Toxic poisoning due to improper eating habits is one of the major causes of impatience and irritability. A doctor once told me that if people would keep their sewer systems as clean as they keep the outside of their bodies, there would be fewer of them calling for a physician.
What trait of personality is next on the list, Mr. Carnegie?
It is humility of the heart. Arrogance, greed, vanity, and egotism are never found in the man who has a pleasing personality.
But isn't humility usually associated somewhat with timidity?
Not in the sense in which I'm using the term. It means a humble spirit based on the recognition that even the greatest of men are, by comparison with the scheme and plan of life generally, but fragments of the whole. Humility of the heart is the result of a true understanding of man's relationship to his Creator, plus recognition that the material blessings of life are a gift of the Creator for the common good of all mankind. The man who is on good terms with his own conscience and in harmony with his Creator always is humble of heart, and he generally has an attractive personality.
I believe we are down to the 22nd trait which comprises an attractive personality. Mr. Carnegie, will you name and discuss it, please?
I call it good showmanship. Showmanship, as one of the traits of attractive personality, is a combination of several of the other traits properly blended and used. It is the ability to combine facial expression, tone of voice, appropriate personal adornment, choice of words, control of the emotions, courtesy, effective speech, versatility, mental attitude, sense of humor, emphasis, and tactfulness in such a manner as to dramatize any circumstance or occasion, so as to attract favorable attention. As the term showmanship is used here, it has no reference to the common habit of wisecracking, clowning, or gossiping, which is used too often as a means of attracting attention. And the next trait of an attractive personality is somewhat related to this one. It is called clean sportsmanship. The man who can win without boasting and lose without squealing generally has the admiration of other people. The colleges advocate clean sportsmanship in athletics because educators know that this habit becomes a part of one's character, and as such it becomes of great benefit in human relationships outside of athletics. Clean sportsmanship is an important trait of attractive personality because it inspires people to cooperate in a friendly manner.
Speaking of a friendly manner, Mr. Carnegie, I have always felt that a man with a good personality reveals it when you first meet him by the way in which he shakes hands.
The ability to shake hands properly has a great deal to do with this subject of an attractive personality. The person who understands how to shake hands effectively can convey very definite impressions of many different types by this means. The man who is skilled in the art of handshaking has a big advantage over the man who lacks this studied accomplishment.
Well, Mr. Carnegie, we have come down to the last of the traits of a pleasing personality. What is it, sir?
It is personal magnetism. Let us be frank at the outset and say that personal magnetism is a polite way of describing sex energy, for that is precisely what it means. Now, we need not evade the admission that sex energy is something with which an individual is born, and it therefore cannot be developed by personal effort. Sex energy is nature's own device with which she creates and perpetuates every living thing, from God's smallest creature to his greatest handiwork, man. I see no reason, therefore, for subterfuge in connection with the analysis of sex emotion as one of the most important traits of personality. But I do see a reason for making it plain that this universal power adds attractive qualities to the personality only when it is controlled and used properly.
What is the method of control you refer to?
I have reference to transmutation, which means the diversion of sex emotion from physical sex expression into whatever constructive purpose one wishes to carry out. It is a well-known fact that when a man who is highly sexed organizes this irresistible creative force and places it back of his occupational endeavors, he has but little difficulty in persuading people to cooperate with him. The emotion of sex must be considered as one of the most important factors of an attractive personality. Therefore, I have given here a clue from which anyone smart enough to recognize it may add greatly to his ability to influence people through his personality.
Cooperation and friendship are two assets that can be had only by first giving them. Employ Applied Faith, Chapter 4.
Can I develop the faith necessary to carry me over the obstacles with which I shall likely meet during my research?
My answer will describe perhaps the most important of the 17 principles of achievement. It is applied faith, and it is one factor of human achievement which gives power to all who apply it. It is the great equalizing force which truly makes all men equal.
Am I to understand you to say, Mr. Carnegie, that all men are born equal? Do you mean that men who have great self-reliance are born with that trait?
Now let me get you straightened out on this vital point before you make the same mistake that so many others have made, of assuming that individuals who achieve outstanding success are born with some peculiar quality of genius not possessed by others. Self-confidence is a state of mind that is under the control of the individual, and it is not an inborn trait possessed by some and lacking in others. There are varying degrees of self-confidence, the reason for which I will explain later. Supreme self-confidence is based upon faith in infinite intelligence, and you may be certain that no one ever attains this state of mind without having a definite belief in infinite intelligence and establishing contact with it. The starting point in the development of self-confidence is definiteness of purpose. That is why this principle was given first place in the philosophy of individual achievement. It is a well-known fact that the man who knows exactly what he wants, has a definite plan for getting it, and is actually engaged in carrying out that plan, has no difficulty in believing in his own ability to succeed. It is equally well known that the man of indecision, the fellow who flounders around and procrastinates, soon loses confidence in his own ability and winds up by doing nothing. There is nothing difficult to understand about this.
But what happens when one knows what he wants, has a plan for getting it, puts his plan into operation, and meets with failure? Doesn't failure destroy self-confidence?
This is the very question I hoped you would ask. It gives me an opportunity to set you right on a common mistake that many people make. Failure has one peculiar benefit that is deserving of emphasis, and it is the fact that every failure carries with it, in the circumstance of the failure itself, the seed of an equivalent advantage. Examine the records of the truly great leaders in all walks of life, and you will discover that their success is in exact proportion to their mastery of failures. Life has a way of developing strength and wisdom in individuals through temporary defeat and failure, and do not overlook the fact that there is no such reality as a permanent failure until an experience has been accepted as such. The power of the mind is so great that it has no limitations other than those which individuals set up in their own minds. The power that removes all limitations from the mind is faith, and I have emphasized the fact that the source of all faith is belief in infinite intelligence. Once you have reached an understanding of this truth, you will not need to worry about self-confidence, for you will possess it in abundance.
Most people are not experienced philosophers, and they are not going to believe that every failure carries with it the seed of an equivalent advantage when failure overtakes them. What I want to know is this. What is one going to do when he meets with failure and the experience destroys his confidence in himself? To whom does such a person turn for aid in the restoration of confidence in himself?
Your question at first appears to be one that is very difficult to answer, but the appearance is deceiving, as I shall explain. Let me answer you briefly in this way. The best way to guard against being overcome by failure is to discipline the mind to meet failure before it arrives. This can best be accomplished by forming habits that enable one to take full possession of his mind and use it for the attainment of definite ends on all occasions, from the smallest to the greatest daily task.
Mr. Carnegie, how does one go about taking possession of his own mind, as you suggest?
The answer to that question is the burden of this entire philosophy, as no one may take complete possession of his mind until he assimilates and puts into action the entire 17 principles of the philosophy. The starting point, as I have stated, is the adoption of a definite major purpose. The second step consists of the formation of a master-mind alliance. The third step is the development of an attractive personality, with which one may properly relate himself to the members of his mastermind group and with others who are essential in the achievement of his major purpose. The fourth step consists of a form of mental discipline, which we have designated as applied faith, the details of which we are now analyzing. Faith is the power that gives effectiveness to the other three principles, and it is a state of mind that anyone can develop and use.
Is there a law or a formula behind the principle of faith, which a person may lay hold of and follow through to a definite end?
Before beginning the analysis of the formula through which faith is acquired, let me remind you that there is a law known as the law of harmonious attraction, through the operation of which like attracts like. With the aid of this law, the successful man either deliberately or unknowingly makes his own mind success-conscious by vitalizing it with a keen desire for the achievement of his major purpose. It is a known fact that men of great achievement form the habit of making an obsession of their definite major purpose. In extreme cases, this obsession becomes intensified until it reaches the proportion of self-hypnosis.
How does one go about the development of that state of mind which you mention as an obsession?
It is accomplished by adopting a definite purpose or plan and backing it with a burning desire for its realization. Here, the habit of repetition of thought comes into action. The habit may be developed by making the object of one's plan or purpose the dominating thought of the mind. If the desire back of the plan or purpose is strong enough, it will have the effect of calling into the mind a picture of the object of the purpose, and of dwelling upon that picture at all times when the mind is not occupied with less important subjects. This is the way that all obsessions are developed. The more one thinks and talks of an idea or plan, the nearer it comes to being an obsession. Here, the mastermind roundtable discussions become powerful factors in vitalizing one's mind with the necessary obsessional quality.
I have heard it said that a man comes finally to believe anything he repeats often, even though it is a falsehood, and some of the political demagogues seem to capitalize on this principle.
That's quite true. The principle of repetition is the medium through which one may fan his desires into a burning flame of intensity. Any thought that is expressed orally and continuously repeated from day to day, through mastermind discussions and otherwise, will be taken over by the subconscious mind eventually and carried out to its logical conclusion. All great leaders who make life pay on their own terms, through what the world commonly calls success, do so by giving orders to their own minds in the manner I have suggested. The mind can take and carry out orders just as if it were a person, and it will act first upon one's dominating thoughts, whether or not they are given as direct orders. Thoughts of limitation and poverty will be carried out to their logical conclusion, which is poverty. The subconscious mind acts on one's thoughts without trying to modify or change their nature in the least. Moreover, it acts automatically, whether or not one is conscious of this action.
If I understand you clearly, Mr. Carnegie, one can develop self-confidence by thinking in terms of what one desires to do and can do, and by excluding thoughts of the difficulties one may encounter in carrying out one's plans.
You have the idea precisely. While I was working as a laborer, I heard a fellow worker say, "I hate poverty and I'll not endure it." He is still doing day labor and lucky to have a job. You see, he fixed his mind on poverty, and that is what his subconscious mind gave him. It would have been different if he had said, "I enjoy riches and I shall earn and receive them." It would have helped, too, if he had gone still one step further and described what sort of service he intended to give in return for the riches he desired.
Then the mind brings the physical equivalent of that which it dwells upon.
Make no mistake about the fact that it does so, and brings it by the shortest, most economical and practical means available, by using every opportunity to achieve the object of one's desires.
What is the effect of two or more people joining the forces of their minds and working harmoniously for the attainment of their definite purpose?
They attain the object of that purpose much more quickly than they could if they worked independently. When the leaders in a business organization begin to think, talk, and act together in a spirit of harmony, they generally get that which they seek. It is true that people can talk and think themselves into anything they desire. Thoughts are things, and powerful things at that. They are more powerful when expressed in the words of an individual who knows exactly what he wants, and more powerful still when they are expressed in the words of a group of people who think, speak, and act together.
From what you have said, Mr. Carnegie, I understand that when the people of a community or a nation begin to think and act in connection with any definite objective, they soon find ways and means of attaining it.
That is not only my belief, but it is a fact. If the newspapers begin to publish stories about wars, and the people begin to think and talk of war in their daily conversations, they soon find themselves at war. People get that which their minds dwell upon, and this applies to a group, or a community, or a nation of people, the same as to an individual. One reason why we Americans are the richest and the freest people in the world, and perhaps this is the only reason, is the fact that we think and talk and act in terms of freedom and riches. Our nation was literally born of our desire for liberty. Our history books are filled with the spirit of liberty. We have talked of liberty so much that we have it in abundance. We shall cease to have it if we stop talking and thinking about it.
Mr. Carnegie, can you give me an illustration of how people get that about which they think and talk?
Why, just go back to the history of this country and study the events that led up to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Here you will discover something that most students of history overlook entirely, namely, the real source of the power that enabled George Washington's armies to win over vastly superior and better equipped armies. The power of which I speak is the power that began in the form of a definite purpose in the minds of a few men. It extended itself through the master-mind relationships of these men until it gave this country the liberty and freedom we now enjoy.
Well, Mr. Carnegie, this is certainly a new story for me. Tell me how it came about, if you please.
It started definitely with three men, John Hancock, Samuel Adams, and Richard Henry Lee, who communicated freely, mostly by correspondence, expressing their views and hopes regarding the freedom of the colonies. From this practice, Samuel Adams conceived the idea that a mutual exchange of letters between the prominent people of the 13 colonies might help to bring about the coordination of efforts so badly needed to solve their common problems. Accordingly, a committee of correspondence was organized. This move increased the power of the mastermind alliance of the three men by adding to it men from all the colonies. These three men did not content themselves by merely writing letters, but they kept up the agitation by correspondence until it led, finally, to the historic meeting in Independence Hall in Philadelphia, at which 56 men signed their names to the document that was destined to give birth to a new nation, the Declaration of Independence. They were motivated by an active faith.
This is a thrilling chapter of our history indeed, Mr. Carnegie. Was it actually that simple?
It was far from simple, but the principles at work are simple. While the letter-writing program was going on, Samuel Adams and John Hancock called a secret meeting of their close friends for the purpose of outlining the steps necessary to translate their definite purpose into action. When the meeting had been called to order, Samuel Adams locked the door, placed the key in his pocket, and calmly told those present that it was imperative a Congress of the Colonists be organized, and informed them that no man would be permitted to leave the room until the decision for such a Congress had been reached. Here is more evidence of active faith. Through the influence of Hancock and Adams, the others present were induced to agree that, through the Correspondence Committee, arrangements would be made for a meeting of the First Continental Congress, to be held in Philadelphia September 5, 1774, almost 2 years before the actual signing of the Declaration of Independence. Remember this date, and remember the two determined men who brought it about. For if there had been no decision to hold a Continental Congress, there could have been no signing of the Declaration of Independence. Passive faith never would have led to this daring move.
I must say that we need some of that brand of faith in our nation today.
Agitation was kept up by correspondence and by secret meetings between the members of the Mastermind Alliance organized by Hancock, Adams, and Lee for almost 2 years, resulting in the famous meeting at Philadelphia in 1776. By this time, the Mastermind had grown to 56 men. The meeting lasted for several days, during which those men engaged in the most stupendous roundtable conversations known to modern civilization. On June 7, 1776, Richard Henry Lee recognized that the time for mere conversations had come to an end, and the time for action had arrived. He rose, addressed the chair, and to the startled assembly made this motion: "Gentlemen, I make the motion that the United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they be absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved." Out of that motion, based on active faith, was born the world's greatest nation. Out of that motion was born the spirit that gave Washington soldiers the power to win over seemingly insurmountable difficulties. Study carefully what happened, and you will see that these men devoted nearly 2 years of highly concentrated effort to the preparation of their minds for the performance, through active faith, of a difficult and dangerous task.
Describing it as a difficult and dangerous task is putting it mildly. Each of those men was literally sticking his neck out, as the slang saying goes, for a hangman's noose as a traitor to the crown.
I have told you this bit of history because it is in a similar manner that all great leaders condition their minds for unusual tasks. This is how men acquire self-confidence. This is an example of the method by which faith is developed through deeds. Remember the fact that action must follow the adoption of a definite purpose. Without action, plans and aims are fruitless. The three men who started America on the road to liberty and freedom made use of the self-same principles of achievement that must be used by the successful leader in business or in any other calling. In the development of self-confidence, as in all other worthy undertakings, one must begin with a motive based upon a definite purpose.
I believe I now understand the procedure by which self-confidence may be acquired. Now, Mr. Carnegie, will you, for the purpose of emphasis, explain how you applied these principles in the crowning achievement of your career, when you converted all your holdings into the United States Steel Corporation?
First, I applied the principle of definiteness of purpose by reaching a decision to consolidate all my steel industrial interests into one company and to sell the company. Second, having decided to sell, I called certain members of my mastermind group together, and we spent several weeks in analysis of the values of my properties in order that I might set a fair price for my interests. We also had to work out a plan by which to find buyers for the properties and arrange ways and means of approaching prospective buyers without placing ourselves at a great disadvantage, since the buyers would know in advance that we were desirous of selling. The complete plan represented the combined efforts of the members of my mastermind group, who sat in on the discussions, and myself. And it was so devised that instead of our being in the position of offering our properties for sale, we would be approached by the buyers with an offer to purchase the properties. This we accomplished with very little maneuvering by arranging a dinner in New York City, at which my chief mastermind aide, Charlie Schwab, and a group of Wall Street bankers whom we had chosen as prospective buyers would be guests. Mr. Schwab was to deliver a speech painting a vivid picture of the great possibilities of such a consolidation of my steel interests into one company, as we had planned. The speech had all the earmarks of being spontaneous, as Schwab made it clear that the plan he outlined could be carried out only by gaining my consent, and gave no indication that he already had that. The speech made such an impression that the meeting lasted into the late hours of the night. And before Schwab left, the bankers present at the meeting, including J.P. Morgan, gained from him a promise to place the proposed plan before me, and to do what he could to gain my consent to it. Not until long after the deal had been closed and I had been paid off did the bankers learn that the speech was carefully planned months in advance.
From that story, I gather the fact that your confidence in your ability to sell your properties was so great that you planned every move well in advance of your knowledge as to who the actual buyers would be.
Every move was planned in advance, but we had a pretty good idea who our buyers would be. However, we planned this particular transaction no more carefully than we planned every business move we made in the operation of our steel industry. Faith has sounder legs to stand upon when it is backed by definite plans. Applied faith is never based on blind moves. Blind faith is something of which I know nothing. The only sort of faith I know anything about is that which is supported by some combination of facts or reasonable assumption of facts. One of the major purposes of a mastermind alliance is that of providing one with reliable knowledge upon which to build plans. With such knowledge in hand, you can readily see how easy it is to develop that state of mind known as faith.
That statement appears to contradict your earlier statement that supreme self-confidence is based on belief in infinite intelligence. If you do not recognize blind faith and have faith only in provable facts or knowledge, how do you justify your faith in infinite intelligence, since definite knowledge on this subject is elusive?
You have made the mistake of assuming that there is no source of definite knowledge about infinite intelligence. As a matter of fact, the existence and the working principles of infinite intelligence are more easily proved than any other fact.
Will you please give me a few reasons why you hold this belief?
In the first place, the orderliness of all natural law and all that we know of the universe is indisputable evidence that there is back of all this a universal plan, a form of intelligence far superior to that which we human beings understand. I can see it in the predictable movements and positions of the stars and planets, which can be calculated and foretold hundreds of years in advance. I can see it in the mystery that brings together two small cells, each no longer than the fine point of a pin, and converts them into the marvelous machine we call man, carrying in those two small particles of energy, matter, and intelligence a portion of the ancestral qualities of man for generations back. There are many theories which are not provable, but infinite intelligence is not one of them. And I may as well tell you here that I believe the power with which we think and reason is nothing other than a minute portion of infinite intelligence functioning through man's brain. It is fairly obvious that infinite intelligence works through the minds of men and uses the most practical natural media available for carrying out the plans of the Creator. Once you acquire this viewpoint, you will be better prepared to depend upon faith in carrying out the task I have assigned you. You mentioned the fact that the task I have given you calls for more self-confidence than you possess. Here, then, I am offering you a viewpoint which, if you will accept it and act upon it, will provide you with a form of inspiration vastly greater than self-reliance. It will give you access to an abundance of faith with which your success is assured even before you begin your task. I sincerely hope that you will open your mind to the guidance of this faith.
At the close of our last discussion, Mr. Carnegie, you made the statement that infinite intelligence works through the minds of men and uses the most practical natural media available for carrying out the plans of the Creator. While you were speaking, the thought was running through my mind that the human brain, with its intricate system for receiving and sending thoughts, is the greatest of all the evidence of your theory that infinite intelligence is the real source of the power of thought. If this is correct, and I believe it to be, it is equally true that the greatest of all sources of power for the solution of our problems of life is that which is available through our own minds. Have I caught your viewpoint on this subject, sir?
You have, and now I wish to take you for a little trip into the inner workshop of my own mind, where you will be permitted to take inventory of the vast resources of the mind as I see them. Once you have a complete perspective of the actual service the mind performs, I believe you will never again lack the self-reliance to draw upon the forces available to you through your mind for every need of life. And I believe, too, that you will have no difficulty in opening your mind, at will, for the guidance of infinite intelligence when you are faced with problems you cannot solve through reliance on your own reason.
I shall consider it a rare privilege, Mr. Carnegie, to have your comments on the mind's vast store of riches. What peculiarity of the mind do you consider to be most significant?
The most significant fact is that the mind is the only thing over which an individual has complete control. Surely the Creator did not provide man with this astounding prerogative without thereby conveying the definite idea that it is man's greatest asset. It also involves a responsibility to use and develop this asset. And second only to this right to control the mind is the important and equally significant fact that the mind has been wisely provided with a conscience to guide it in the use of the vast power it carries. It is also highly significant that the mind has been carefully screened against all outside intruders through a system that makes possible the opening and the closing of the mind at will.
You speak of opening and closing the mind as though it were equipped with a door or a gate or some type of shutters. Will you please clarify your meaning on this point, Mr. Carnegie?
The mind has been cleverly provided with a gateway of approach to infinite intelligence through what is known as the subconscious mind. And this gateway has been so arranged that it cannot be opened for voluntary use except by the mind that has been first prepared by faith. However, the gateway can be opened voluntarily, from the other side, as it were, by infinite intelligence, when communication with man is necessary and without his consent. Man's control over his own mind relates only to his conscious mind.
Someone has said that the imagination is the workshop of the soul. Would you like to comment on that statement?
Well, of this I'm quite sure. The mind has been provided with a faculty of imagination, wherein may be fashioned ways and means of translating hope and purpose into physical reality. This is evidence to me that imagination is indeed the workshop of the conscious mind. Also, the mind has been provided with the stimulative capacity of desire and enthusiasm, with which man's plans and purposes may be given action through the imagination. It has been provided with the power of will, through which both plan and purpose may be sustained indefinitely, thereby giving man adequate power to master fear and discouragement and opposition. It has been given the capacity for faith, through which the will and the reasoning faculty can be subdued while the entire machinery of the brain is turned over to the guiding force of infinite intelligence. Get the full significance of this fact, and you will be near to the method by which one may develop faith.
I have often heard you refer to the sixth sense of the mind. Just what do you mean by that term?
The sixth sense prepares the mind for direct connection with other minds, thus making possible the operation of the mastermind principle, by which it may add to its own power the stimulative forces of other minds that serve so effectively at times to stimulate the imagination. The mind has been given the power to project itself into other minds through what is known as telepathy, and it may do so freely under two circumstances. First, where other minds have been left open, either voluntarily or neglectfully, and second, where a relationship of harmony and oneness of purpose has been arranged between two or more minds, as in the case of the mastermind alliance.
So far, you have not mentioned the two rather obvious functions of the mind, the faculty of reason and the power of deduction. Where do these fit into your conception of the mind?
The mind, through its capacity to reason, may combine facts and theories into hypotheses, ideas, and plans. By the power of deduction, the philosopher analyzes the past in order to predict the future. The mind has the power to select, modify, and control the nature of its thoughts, thus giving man the privilege of building his own character and of determining what sort of thoughts shall dominate his mind.
And what a power that is! I recall how you have repeatedly said that the dominating thoughts a person holds in his mind determine the set of his sails.
Yes, and the mind has an unlimited capacity to receive, organize, and store knowledge. It has been provided with a marvelous filing system for recording and recalling every thought it has expressed through what is called memory. This astonishing system automatically classifies and files related thoughts in such a manner that the recall of one particular thought leads to the remembrance of its associated thoughts. And the mind functions secretly and in absolute silence, thereby assuring privacy under all circumstances.
What might one say about the power of the mind over the functions of the physical body?
It has the power to aid in the maintenance of the health of the physical body, and apparently is the sole source of cure of physical ills, all other sources being merely contributory. It also keeps the physical body in repair. It controls and directs, automatically, a marvelous system of chemistry through which it converts all food taken into the body into suitable combinations for the sustenance of the body. It automatically operates the heart with which the bloodstream is circulated to distribute food to the places where it is needed and to carry off the waste materials and the worn-out cells of the body.
Would you say that the mind has a spiritual function in addition to the physical functions you have just enumerated?
The mind is the common meeting ground wherein man may commune with the Creator through prayer, process of setting aside the power of the will, and opening the gateway of the subconscious mind through faith. It has been given the power of emotion or feeling through which it can stimulate the body for any desired action at will. It is the source of all happiness and all misery, of both poverty and riches of every nature whatsoever, and it devotes its energies to whichever of these is dominated by the power of thought. It is the source of all human relationships, the builder of friendships, the creator of enemies, according to the manner in which it is used. It has no limitations within reason, save only those which the individual accepts through his lack of faith. Truly, whatever the mind can believe, the mind can achieve.
To what extent do people generally avail themselves of the wonderful faculties of the mind which you have mentioned?
Regrettably, with all this miraculous power, the majority of the people of the world permit themselves to be cowed by fears of difficulties which do not exist save in their own imaginations. The arch enemy of mankind is fear.
Perhaps it would be a good idea to name some of the most common fears which we permit to enter our minds and thereby become literally self-imposed limitations.
We fear poverty in the midst of an overabundance of riches. We fear ill health in spite of the ingenious system nature has provided by which the physical body is automatically maintained in working order. We fear criticism when there are no critics save those which we set up through our own imaginations. We fear the loss of love of friends and relatives, although we know well enough that our own conduct is sufficient to maintain love through all ordinary circumstances of human relationships. We fear old age, whereas we should accept it as a medium of greater wisdom and understanding. We fear the loss of liberty, although we know that liberty is a matter of harmonious relationships with others. We fear death when we know it is inevitable, therefore beyond our control. We fear failure, not recognizing that every failure carries with benefit. Instead of opening our minds for the guidance of infinite intelligence through faith, we close our minds tightly with every conceivable shade and degree of limitation based upon our necessary fears.
But, Mr. Carnegie, how may one develop faith? I'm sure that any help you can give along this line will be greatly appreciated. I repeat the question, sir. How may one develop faith?
I'll tell you how. Faith may be developed by clearing the mind of its enemies. Clear the mind of negative thoughts and fears and self-imposed limitations, and lo, faith has filled the place without effort. If you cannot take my word for this, try it for yourself and be forever convinced. There is no great mystery about the state of mind known as faith. Give it a place to dwell, and it will move in without ceremony or invoking about practicing it. What could be more simple? We preach sermons and offer up prayers in the name of Christ, yet we rarely make more than a gesture at following his admonition for us to liquidate our problems through the simple state of mind known as faith. We build great edifices of worship in the name of Christ, yet we profane them with minds that are steeped in fear and self-imposed limitations, which he clearly promised us we need not endure.
You are surely speaking plainly on this subject, and I hope people will profit by it.
If I seem to speak plainly, be assured it is because I feel that mankind needs the quickening influence of plain speech to shock people into recognizing that everything they need or want is already within their grasp. All they need to do is to take possession of their own minds and use them. To do this, man has no one to consult except himself. The approach to liberty, freedom, and abundance of the material necessities and luxuries of life is through the individual's mind. This mind is the only thing over which he has complete control. Yet, it is the one thing he so seldom uses intelligently.
Mr. Carnegie, would you care to name some examples of men who have taken possession of their own minds, and with what results?
Once in a great while, the world is blessed by the presence of one who takes control of his mind and uses it for the good of mankind. Then it is found a genius, an Edison, an Aristotle, a Plato, or a great leader in thought and in action in some field of useful endeavor. Columbus took possession of his mind and gave us a new world which now serves as the last frontier of human liberty and freedom. Orville and Wilbur Wright took possession of their minds and gave man wings and mastery of the air. Johannes Gutenberg took possession of his mind and gave us movable type and thereby made possible every book we possess and gave us the means of preserving the accumulated experience of mankind for the benefit of generations yet unborn. The list could go on and on. Let us learn from these outstanding examples of achievement one great lesson we all need to know, and that is the obvious fact that self-reliance and faith are based on definiteness of purpose, backed by definite plans of action. Procrastination and faith have nothing in common.
From what you have said, Mr. Carnegie, the best way to start developing faith is by choosing an objective and beginning at once to attain it through whatever media available. Have I understood you correctly?
Quite correctly, lad. The development of faith is largely a matter of understanding the astounding power of the mind. The only real mystery about faith is man's failure to make use of it. I speak from personal experience when I say that faith is a state of mind which can be acquired and used as effectively and easily as any other state of mind. It is all a matter of understanding and application. Truly, faith without works is dead. My early days of youth were cursed by poverty and limitation of opportunity, a fact with which all who know me are acquainted. I am no longer cursed by poverty, because I took possession of my mind, and that mind has yielded to me every material thing I want, and much more than I need. Faith is no patented right of mine. It is a universal power as available to the humblest person as it is to the greatest.
Your description of the possibilities of the human mind is both interesting and revealing, Mr. Carnegie. In all the reading I have done on the subject of psychology and the working principles of the mind, I have found nothing that approaches, even approximately, your description of the powers of the mind. Where did you acquire all this knowledge?
What knowledge I have of the powers of the mind I acquired from the greatest of all schools, the University of Life. It has been a habit of mine, extending backward over many years, to devote a certain amount of time daily to silent meditation and thought in connection with the plan and purpose and working principles of the mind. Some might call this habit getting in tune with the infinite. At any rate, it is a habit I shall continue as long as I live, and I heartily recommend it to all who wish to become better acquainted with the powers of their own minds. I have one other suggestion to offer that may be helpful in the development of faith, and that is the fact that all who master and apply the other 16 principles of the philosophy of American achievement will thus have placed themselves within easy reach of faith. This entire philosophy is one of action. It inspires effort based on definiteness of purpose, and this is exactly what is required in the development of faith.
Go the Extra Mile. Chapter 5. Early one frosty morning, the private railroad car of Charles M. Schwab was shifted to the sidetrack at his steel plant in Pennsylvania. As he left the car, he was met by a young man who explained that he was a stenographer in the office of the steel company, and he had met the car with the hope that he might be of some service to Mr. Schwab. "Who requested you to meet me here?" Schwab asked. "It was my own idea, sir," the young man replied. "And I knew you were coming on the early morning train because I handled a telegram that stated you were coming. I brought my notebook with me, sir, and I'll be glad to take any letters or telegrams you may wish to send." Mr. Schwab thanked the young man for his thoughtfulness, but said he needed no service at the moment, although he might send for the lad later in the day. And he did. When the private car returned to New York that night, it carried that young man back to the city where he had been assigned at Mr. Schwab's request for duty in the steel magnate's private office. The young man's name was Williams. We do not recall his first name, but that is unimportant. What we do recall is the fact that Mr. Williams promoted himself from one job to another in the steel organization until he earned and saved enough money to enable him to go into business for himself, and he later founded a drug company of which he became the president and majority stockholder. Nothing dramatic or interesting about this brief story, is there? Well, the answer depends altogether upon what one calls true. To every man who is trying to find his place in the world, this story, if analyzed carefully, carries the deepest sort of drama. For it describes the practical application of one of the more important of the 17 principles of individual achievement, the habit of going the extra mile. We said that this young man, Williams, promoted himself from one job to another in the steel company. Let us find out how he managed this self-promotion in order that we may learn how others can profit by his technique. Let us learn, if we can, what young Williams had in the way of ability which other stenographers in the General Plant Operation Office of the steel company did not have, that caused him to be singled out by Mr. Schwab and assigned to his personal service. We have Mr. Schwab's own word that young Williams did not possess a single quality that entitled him to rate above the average as a stenographer, but he did have one quality, a quality that he developed on his own initiative and practiced as an inviolable habit, which but few people possess, and that was the habit of rendering more service and better service than he was paid for. It was this habit that enabled him to promote himself. It was this habit that attracted the attention of Mr. Schwab. It was this habit that helped him to become the head of a corporation where he became also his own boss. And it was this habit, as we shall soon see from Andrew Carnegie's analysis of the subject in this chapter, which many years previous to the incident here related brought Mr. Schwab himself to the attention of Mr. Carnegie and gained for him his opportunity to promote himself into a position in which he became his own boss. It was also this same habit that enabled the irrepressible Carnegie to rise from the position of day laborer to that of the owner of America's largest industry, where he accumulated a vast fortune in money and a still greater fortune in useful knowledge, which is now available to the people of America who have the vision and the ambition to appropriate and use it. Mr. Carnegie's views on the subject of going the extra mile provide the students of this philosophy with a practical working technique with which they may use this principle effectively for their own self-promotion. His analysis of the subject is here presented in his own words.
"Mr. Carnegie, I have heard some men express the belief that success often is the result of luck. Many people seem to believe that successful men achieve their success because they get the favorable breaks of life, and that others fail because they get the unfavorable breaks. Croesus, the wealthy Persian philosopher, made some such reference to chance when he said, 'There is a wheel on which the affairs of men revolve, and its mechanism is such that it prevents any man from being always fortunate.' Have you, in the richness of your business experience, seen any evidence of such a wheel? Do you attribute any portion of your success to luck or favorable breaks?"
"Your questions give me a suitable starting point for an appropriate description of the fifth of the 17 principles of achievement. Let us call it the habit of going the extra mile, by which I mean the habit of rendering more service and better service than one is paid for. First, I will answer your questions by saying yes, indeed, there is a wheel of life that controls human destinies, and I am happy to be able to tell you that this wheel can be definitely influenced to operate in one's favor. If this were not true, there would be no object in organizing the rules of personal achievement.
Will you tell me, in the simplest words possible, just how one may control this wheel of fortune? I would like a description of this important success factor which the young man or young woman just beginning a business career may understand.
First of all, to control the wheel of fortune, one must understand, master, and apply the 17 principles of achievement. I have already named 5 of these principles, and I might here suggest that these 5, if properly applied, will carry one a long way on the road toward success in any calling.
Am I to understand that the 5 principles of definiteness of purpose, the mastermind, attractive personality, applied faith, and going the extra mile are sufficient to ensure one's success?
No, one cannot depend upon these 5 principles alone. There are 12 other principles of achievement which I have not yet mentioned, and you will observe when I explain them that they provide contributory knowledge needed in the attainment of success that one may not acquire from the 5 principles I have already named. The 5 principles are sufficient to enable a man to establish a definite goal in life and determine approximately the amount of wealth he intends to accumulate, what he intends to give in return for that wealth, and so relate himself to other people that they will not place unnecessary obstacles in his way. But one has a considerable distance to travel beyond this point before he attains enduring success by writing his own price tag, as the master of the entire 17 principles may do.
Do you mean to say that there are definite rules of procedure through which a person may literally write his own price tag and be sure of getting it? Surely I must have misunderstood you, because it seems to me that if such rules do exist, there would not be so many poverty-stricken people in the world, especially in view of the fact that we, in America, are surrounded with an abundance of every form of wealth and gifted with the freedom of initiative to choose our own occupation and live our own lives as we choose.
Yes, you understand me correctly, and I will describe the particular rule of success which will, if properly applied, enable a person literally to write his own price tag, with more than an average chance of getting that which he desires. Moreover, this rule is so potent that it practically insures one against serious opposition from those who purchase his services. As I have already stated, this rule is known as the habit of going the extra mile, which means the habit of doing more than one is paid to do. You will observe that I have injected an important word into the description of this rule, the word habit. Before the application of the rule begins to bring back appreciable results, it must become a habit, and it must be applied at all times, in all possible ways. It means that one must render the greatest amount of service of which he is capable, and he must render it in a friendly, harmonious mental manner. Moreover, he must do this regardless of the amount of the immediate compensation he receives, even if he receives no immediate compensation whatsoever.
But, Mr. Carnegie, most of the people I know, those who work for wages or a salary, claim that they are already doing more work than that for which they are paid. If this is true, why aren't they doing a better job of influencing the wheel of fortune in their behalf than they appear to be doing? Why aren't they rich, as you are?
The answer to your question is simple enough, but it has many angles I shall have to explain before you'll understand it. In the first place, if you will accurately analyze those who work for wages, you will learn that 98 out of every 100 have no definite major purpose greater than that of working for a daily wage. Therefore, no matter how much work they do or how well they do it, the wheel of fortune will turn on past them without providing more than a bare living, because they neither expect nor demand more. Ponder over this truth for a moment, and you will be better prepared to follow the logic I will present in the remainder of this lesson. The major difference between those who accept limitation of daily wages sufficient only for a bare living and myself is this. I demand riches in definite terms. I have a definite plan for acquiring riches. I am engaged in carrying out my plan, and I am giving an equivalent in useful service of the value of those riches I demand, while the others have no such plan or purpose. Life is paying me off on my own terms. It is doing precisely the same thing for the man who asks no more than daily wages. You see, the Wheel of Fortune follows the mental blueprint that a man sets up in his own mind, and it brings back to him, in physical or financial measure, an exact equivalent of that blueprint. Unless you grasp the full meaning of this statement of truth, you will miss the important portion of this lesson. There is a law.